So today I'm going to talk primarily about the De Broglie bone model. But before I do that, let me just finish yesterday's subject. So we talked about ontological models, and then we had the flow chart where all the different interpretations fit in. And I just wanted to make a few comments before we go on to the actual interpretations of quantum theory. A few, I think, important things to look out for, few important questions for an interpretation. One, even zero. What is the ontic state? So that helps you see what kind of interpretation it is. Psi ontic, is it psi supplemented, etc. How does this interpretation solve the measurement problem? Two, is the interpretation non-local? As Bell's theorem would suggest. And then finally, is the interpretation a good departure point to make progress in physics? For me, this is really crucial. And in particular, does it help you think about the problem of quantum gravity? So those, I think, are just some points to think about when you assess the usefulness of these different interpretations. But it's not just quantum gravity. You might be interested in quantum cosmology, which is related, or other problems in fundamental physics. Okay. So now let's talk about the De Broglie bone model. De Broglie did his work in 27, 1927, and Bohm in 1952. Okay. So we're going to take the non-relativistic
case.
Non-relativistic case where we have a wave function which is a position of which is a function of the position of a bunch of particles, and the time, and it evolves according to the Schrodinger equation. Okay, and this is a vector in three space. The ontic state in the de Broglie model is given by this, the wave function and a bunch of positions of actual particles, of actual particle positions. So I should explain this point carefully. This is a function. These are arguments of that function. Okay, but then these are the actual positions of actual particles. So we represent the positions of actual particles by uppercase x's.
What does it mean, position of actual particles? How can you know the position of actual particles?
Well, you don't know them, but you don't necessarily know them, but you imagine that there are actual particles that actually have positions.
Oh, so the abstract underlying thing is like classical particles really exist.
Yeah, so you know, classical particles really exist. They really have positions. They really move around space. And so at a given time, This is what you have. I don't think I need to put T again here. This is meant to be at a given time. Sorry. Okay, good. So this is a wave function. And it's on configuration space. It's a function of all these different x's, different positions. And these are the positions. So the actual positions of actual particles. And we'll put, just to make things simple, we'll write x is equal to write this notation, and that notation. Sometimes it's useful. So this is the ontic state at time t. Now we need to know how it changes in time. So what are the dynamics of this ontic state? And it's given by two equations, by two coupled equations. Well, really, it's more than two equations. We have equation. Do we have the Schrodinger equation? And we have this equation. I'll write down which you won't have seen before unless you've studied the de Broglie-Bohm model. So this is the equation for the velocity of the nth particle. This is called the guidance equation. So you can see the velocity of the nth particle depends, and there's one thing I'm missing here. Depends on the wave function over all the particles. The one thing that you have to do after this is evaluate this at the actual positions of the particles. So, so to calculate this, you need to take the wave function and derivatives of the wave function in the lowercase x variables. And then when you've got that, then you evaluate it at the actual position of the particles. And that gives you the velocity of the nth particle. So one thing you can see about this is that it is, in some sense, very non-local, because the velocity of particle n, this particle, depends on the location of all the other particles at that given time. One comment I made at the beginning. So I'm treating the non-relativistic case. You can set up the de Broglie-Bohm model for quantum field theory. You can set it up for the standard model. So you can reproduce all of known physics, at least all of known quantum physics, within this kind of model. You might worry that in the relativistic case, you have this non-locality, this explicit non-locality, and where the velocity of particle n depends on the instantaneous position for the other particles. And that's a very non-relativistic feature. What happens is the particle violates Lorentz invariance fundamental level, But at the statistical level, it recovers rents and variance. So you do have a preferred frame of reference in this model, but it's statistically, you cannot see that preferred frame if you go to the relative statistics. Are there any questions? Okay. So sometimes there's an additional assumption. And the assumption is at time t equal to zero, at the initial time, the density so this is the density of the part of the actual particles. I'll explain what I mean by that more carefully. Is given by t equals zero. Is given by the modulus squared of the wave function. So what this means is you run your experiment. Okay, so for a particular run of the experiment, each particle initially has a given position. Okay. And you do the experiment, and then you run it again. Okay, and again, your particles have some initial position, initial value position, which may be different from the first time. And you repeat it many, many times. So you build up an ensemble by repeated runs. And the distribution of particle positions over that ensemble, this is the distribution over the ensemble, is assumed to be initially equal to the wave function. Sometimes a conceptually tricky point is the fact that we're not talking about particles at a given time. We're talking about an ensemble of built up of repeated instances. Yes. This is the probability density.
To write the wave function or state
on
one part of them, not the whole configuration space.
If your wave function for the big system happens to factorize into a part for a smaller system and everything else, so it's a product state, then you can do that and you can just consider the Bohmian dynamics, Roy-Bohm model for that smaller system. If there's any entanglement, then that fails. No longer do that. Because the moment you have entanglement, the velocity of the particles in your smaller system are affected by the velocities of particles. So those are the positions of the other particles. So then you really need to choose, your whole system has to be in a pure state.
But then it's also the case in the ordinary quantum mechanics that we work with, that if we have entanglement, this state of our particle will depend on the state of other ones, but we still can still define a state for individual particles as well.
So if you have entanglement, then you can't write down a yeah then you can't write down a pure state for the whole system, but you can write down a mixed state for a subsystem, and that doesn't depend on what happens particles. Whereas here, the velocity of particles in the subsystem will depend on all the particles, at least if there's entanglement. If there isn't entanglement, then you can see that it drops out.
You mean like they're entangled not only in their states, but also in the way that...
So entanglement in the quantum states causes the velocity. So if you look in here, I'm not sure how obvious this is. If this state is a product state between some different systems, then I think it's pretty clear that then this partial derivative doesn't affect the product part, and so it cancels top and bottom. So if phi is equal to phi on some of the particles and eta on the remainder of the particles, and you substitute, it's a product state, substitute that in here, then it will, the bit which doesn't contain n will drop out. It's not affected by this partial derivative. But the more typical situation is that you have entanglement, and in that case, there is a non-local influence. So this was the non-local influence that John Bell noticed, the de Broglie-Bell model. It led him to ask the question: Do hidden variable interpretations of quantum theory have to be non-local? So this is, in some sense, is the origin of Bell's.
Position of particles and velocity, the exact dynamic of particles are hidden variables.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, if you do make a measurement, if you put a detector in, then the detector will click with the particle, you know, where the particle is. There are actually situations where that kind of fails, but as long as your detector clicks straight away, then your detector will click where the bohmian particle is. So you can see them by looking, but if you do that, then you'll mess up future prediction. Then different things will happen in the future.
We replace the vector x, large x, into the expectation value of the collision of the particle. So I think we can get the same equation.
So you're replacing, what are you replacing? Replace
so
this?
The expectation value of the particle x.
So you want to replace this with the expectation value. And then you're saying we'd get the same equation. Why do you say that?
Because in our Dirac notations,
I think you might be right. There's the I think expectation values do follow. I think expectation values. This basically comes from the quantum current, and expectation values. That might be true. But conceptually, that's a different thing. That's sort of still an expectation value in the regular sense of quantum theory, whereas this is an actual particle position of some supposed particles that we don't normally take to exist in the regular. Okay. So what happens is if you make this assumption that at time t0 the particles are distributed according to the wave function, then you can prove with these equations, with this guidance equation, if these are all true, then you can prove that the density at later times, let me just abbreviate it like that, is also equal, continues to be equal to the wave function. So if this is true initially, then you can prove that for all later times, it continues to be the case that the density of distributions of the particles, I just abbreviated, it continues to be given by the wave function. But actually, it's also true for all earlier times. But if we're taking this to be the initial time, then we're not interested. That's kind of the key. This is the key fact that makes this interpretation work. So given this key fact, we know that this interpretation gives the same predictions as well as the same predictions as standard quantum theory. This property that if it's true if initially you have this distribution, then it continues to be true, is equivariant. It's called equivariance. If you Google equivariance and de Broglie-Bohm, then you'll find lots of literature. There is a key question, which is, what if you don't have this assumption? What if the initial distribution is not given by the modulus squared of the wave function? In actual fact, why would it be completely unnatural to assume some initial distribution? So you can do that. You can take some distribution which is not initially the wave function squared, and evolve it in time, see what happens. And what's interesting is when you do these simulations, as long as you allow a certain coarse graining of a small cells, you'll find that very quickly, even for quite simple quantum systems, very quickly the wave function will tend to be given by distribution. Even if it's not true initially, after a very short time, after fairly short time scale on the scale of, according to the scales that are set by your problem, you will get this property. And the person who's done a lot of work on that is Anthony Valentini. So what he considers is, if you assume a non-equilibrium initial distribution, by non-equilibrium you mean that this is not equal to that, then you can show, lots of examples, this is the work of Anthony Valentini. So he's shown that both at the sort of theoretical level, in the arbitrary sense, there's a sort of a H mixing theorem, and he's shown it also in lots of computer simulations for particular examples. Okay. So one question you might have is why this particular formula? I'm not going to prove that this is the right formula. I just want to motivate that this is the right formula. So, in standard quantum theory, We have the equation. We have the this quantity. This is the quantum current. What is? Well, let me just define this. So you'll find this equation in textbooks, actually. This is the quantum current of particle n when you're in the wave function, when you're in a certain wave function, psi. And it satisfies so if you define this quantity, which is all of these quantities in a vector form, then you have this equation. And this is a continuity equation. So if you put rho squared equals, psi squared equals rho, then this is a continuity equation. Then then you have, and you also put j equals rho times a velocity. This is now a velocity in configuration space. Then you have so this is the continuity equation for a probability fluid in 3n dimensions. And if you take this equation, then you get the guidance equation. So this is just, I'm just trying to motivate this equation, not prove it, the guidance equation. You can see it, that we have this standard equation for the current in quantum theory, and that when you look at how that relates to this continuity equation, then it motivates particular equation for the velocity. If you look at the papers, the de Broglie-Bohm papers, so in particular, I recommend the paper from 1952 by Bohm, then he has a clear derivation of the guidance formula and then also actually John Bell has some very good papers on this too, so you can see where that really comes from.
Yep. I'm a little confused about reference frames here. Like everyone can go to the reference frame of each of the particles and perform those del n size, but there is also an abstract underlying reference frame in the whole configuration space that we can
use. So I'm not aware of anyone who's thought about relating sort of quantum reference frames to the de Broglie model. I think here we're just assuming there's some big abstract, maybe classical reference frame in the background. Would you like that? So I don't know of anyone who's.
So then what does those derivatives with respect to like particle and what does those mean?
With respect to some big classical background reference frame. So to really get a feel for what this interpretation is saying, it's quite useful to sketch some trajectories, and you can see how it solves, how it reproduces quantum theory. So let's talk about that. So it's quite simple to sketch the trajectories if you simplify things a bit. And there's two principles that you can use to get a pretty good idea of what these trajectories look like. First of all, the no crossing principle. So let me explain that. So the velocity is given by this is the velocity in configuration space at a given time. And each of these x dots is a function of the position. So each of these individual x dots is a function of the position and the wave function. So therefore, the whole thing is just a function. This x dot I've defined is a function of the wave function and the position of the particles in configuration space. This is always true. Actually, this is very different from Newtonian mechanics. So in Newtonian mechanics, you are free initially or anytime, you're free to change, you're free to consider arbitrary velocities for your particles. So at time zero, you have the particles have, in Newtonian mechanics, at time zero, the particles have certain positions and then also certain velocities. You can consider different positions and velocities. In the de Broglie-Bohm model, your velocities are constrained by the positions and the global wave function. So this is quite different in some sense from Newtonian. And Valentini has said this is more like Aristotle's dynamics. It's a first order dynamics.
Those are lowercase x's in the argument.
This is meant to be an uppercase x. So the key point here is that the velocity is a single-valued function of and. I mean, there is a first derivative in here as well. But it's given by psi and x, single valued function. So what that means, if you're sketching trajectories, is that if you have some trajectory like this, in one run, say one member, so say you know, in your first, you have an ensemble of repetitions of the experiment, and if the particle in configuration space goes along a certain trajectory, then for the next run of your experiment, it's impossible to have another particle that does that. Because if that happened, then there'd be a crossing point, and so your velocity would not be single valued. Okay. So this is impossible. Okay, so this is useful to sketch trajectories. It's also very interesting from a physics point of view because it's quite different from Newtonian. And the second point is that if you're sketching these trajectories, you want to be sure that this is true at all times. So let me just sketch some examples. So here's a very simple example. Imagine we have a single particle wave function. That's our system, just one particle. The wave function is initially here, and then it moves in time. And as it moves, it will spread slightly. So so we have a wave function initially. It's the wave function like this. Initially, it's here, and then it sort of evolves in time and spreads slightly as it does so. Okay. So the initial wave function might be like this, and then at some later time, the wave function has spread to be like that. And then, if we have particle positions in here, let's consider different positions. Well, these particle positions have to spread out in the final. I'm going to have you 1, 2, 5. They have to spread out, and also they can't cross. So what's going to happen is they'll just evolve from here to here. The trajectories would look something like that. Okay, so that's very simple, kind of boring. Here's another example. Imagine you have in the x direction you have a barrier, a potential barrier. So you have a wave function coming in. It hits this barrier. Part of the wave function will tunnel through the barrier, and part of it will be reflected. So on a space-time diagram, we'll have some initial wave function coming in. It'll be like this initially. Then we have, let's just draw the barrier here. Then it will hit the barrier. So the wave function will come in, hit the barrier, some of it will be reflected, some of it will be transmitted. lost that. Let's just draw some particle positions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The particles, so the positions at the front of the wave packet will have to be transmitted, because if these positions were reflected, then to preserve the density, just the density to the 0.2, to preserve the density, they would have to cross the ones. So it's not possible. You don't want to have these ones reflected and the ones at the back transmitted. So you have to have the ones at the front transmitted. And also they have to spread out. As they are transmitted, they have to spread out to fill the entire width of the wave packet as it goes through, because the wave packet will remain, I have a certain width, which is wider than just the front part of this. And the ones at the back will be reflected. Actually, they'll have their position in the queue kind of reversed. The one at the very back will end up at the front. Otherwise it would be they'd be crossing. And these ones have to spread as well to fill the entire width of the wave packet. So that's what happens at a barrier. Go ahead.
Do you know if the ability to cross depends on the dimension of the space that we're living in?
So the no-crossing principle is true for the configuration space. So whatever system you have, it's true for the whole configuration space. Okay, so it's true in 3n dimensions, and there's the number of particles you have. Here I'm considering just a one-dimensional, one spatial dimension, and one particle. So there you can really see it can't cross. But it's also true in any number of dimensions that you can't. It's true in any number of dimensions you can't cross. And what could happen, according to the rules I've given you, is you could get some kind of twisting behavior. So this property that the particle at the back ends up at the front. You could get some kind of twisting, and that might fail to be true. Actually, when you do the simulations in, say, 3 dimensions, if you simulate this in 3 dimensions, then that doesn't work. That doesn't happen. And the pictures are pretty much the same as what I've drawn here, just extrapolated to 3 dimensions. And the reason for that is that these equations do satisfy certain sort of the underlying trajectories do end up satisfying certain sort of natural symmetries coming from Galilean invariants. So that's what actually happens. So these sketches are a pretty good representation of what actually happens even in high dimensions.
The non-crossing principle seems to be an additional constraint on De Broglie-Bohm model, and this function f seems to be very special.
So it's not an additional. It's already a constraint we had over here. So these equations here, all I'm doing is just looking at the functional form of this equation. So it follows from this equation here that it. Exactly like that. The function f is given by this. So this no crossing principle is not additional. It's not an additional principle. It's necessary, given this guidance equation. So these are both. These are very simple examples. So you also get, I just want to show you what happens in a double slit interferometer. So rather than trying to draw this, can you just distribute these around? I think I need, actually, can you pass the one back to those guys? And I need one more as well for myself. Yeah. Okay. So this is the diagram for the double slit interferometer. What's interesting is, so back in, you know, Bohm wrote his papers in 1952, and then he kind of got disinterested in the De Broglie model and stopped thinking about it. And then in the 60s, some students of De Broglie Bohm, Chris Dewdney, the one I know, plotted these diagrams. Now, this was in the 1960s. If you wanted to do a computer simulation like this in the 1960s, you had to, you know, program out these really old-fashioned computers. He had to, his program was contained in a stack of cards with holes punched in it. You know, he had to take that to some special place where they had a machine that could read this code. And anyway, he was able to produce these simulations. He even had a video, which in the early days of Perimeter, when we were in the old building, he came and visited and brought the video and played this old video he'd made. And we needed to get a special projector to play it with all these simulations and so on. So back in the day, this was quite a difficult thing to do. Now it just takes you, you know, a couple of minutes on any computing device at hand. So let me just talk for this. So what we have here is, in an individual run, particle comes along, and either it gets absorbed by the diaphragm, or it goes through one slit or the other. So let's imagine it goes through this slit. Then the particle will follow this kind of wiggly trajectory and end up on the screen at the back. If you look at the trajectories here, they're such that if you place a screen anywhere, you'll get the interference fringes that you expect. You'll get a high intensity here. You'll have certain places where there's no particles arriving, the wiggles accomplish that. Another interesting feature is so the wave functions come through and they spread out. So initially, when the particles first emerge from this slit, the wave function from the other slit hasn't reached this here. So these paths coming out of each slit are initially straight lines. And it's only when the wave packet coming from the other slit starts to reach these positions that these particles start to wiggle, you get the interference. Another property is, you know, we always say, well, if you detect the particle here, we have no idea which slit it came through.
Okay.
In a De Broglie Bohm model, that's not true. If you detect the particle over here, then you know for sure it came from that slit. If you detect the particle over here, you know for sure it came from that slit. So this is a fun diagram. I mean, of course, you have to believe the De Broglie Bohm model to believe the truth of that assertion. If you do, then you know which slit the particle came through. Okay. Trying to think. So the next thing I want to do is just to talk about measurement in the De Broglie Bohm model. So, like I mentioned on Monday, De Broglie in 1927 set up the same model as Bohm did later, but De Broglie didn't treat measurement. So consequently, when he was showing some examples of how the De Broglie Bohm model would actually work, he got disillusioned and stopped working on it. Whereas Bohm showed how to treat measurement, and so that gave him confidence that the model was really reproducing quantum theory all the way through. So I'll show you how measurement works in the De Broglie Bohm model. It's interesting because you get effective collapse of the wave function. What I mean by that is, if you get a certain outcome of your measurement on the measurement device, then the wave function doesn't collapse. It stays what it was before. However, part of the wave function that's not associated with your measurement outcome, your system, so the part that's not associated, becomes irrelevant for the future trajectories of the particle. So effectively, you can just cross it out in the mathematics, and it doesn't matter. So you have this effective collapse. Trying to think what else to say about this. What happened with De Broglie in 1927 was they looked at some examples. They looked, so people at the 1927 Solvay conference looked at this equation, this one here, and they said, well, if your wave function is real, then the velocity is zero. That's actually not completely obvious there, but it's true. If the wave function is real, then the velocity vanishes. You have no, so the particle just stays where it is. So that meant, for example, if you were looking at the an atom, and you had an electron in the ground state, then the electron would just stay where it was. It's very strange. Seemed unphysical at the time. But that's a prediction of the Rubel model, that the electron in the ground state of an atom doesn't move. It.
What is the situation that wave function can be real? Like in general, wave function can be.
So generally, wave functions are not real. They're complex. So you know the excited states. Of wave function.
Like it cannot happen because wave function is complex, right?
Sorry, what cannot happen?
The fact that wave function be real and then particles they are just.
Say that they are. Yeah. So I'm just saying, general wave functions are not real. They're complex. There are physical situations where the wave function is real. And so then the particles just remain stationary. Anyway, so it's counterintuitive. My opinion is that it doesn't matter because any interpretation of quantum theory is going to have counterintuitive properties. So this is one for the de Broglie model. Not that I believe that a Broglie model is correct, but it's fun to explore.
People try to test this.
Well, the thing is, if you try to probe it, you say, well, let's see where the particle is, and then so you have to introduce some interaction with another system, and then suddenly the particle starts moving and will reproduce all the predictions of quantum theory. So you can't really test it. It's not the predictions are the same as regular quantum theory. If you what you could do in principle is you could perform a bunch of measurements on the positions of the electrons in the ground state of atoms. That wouldn't have been possible in 1920. Might be possible now, I'm not entirely sure. In principle, you could do that. What you'd find is that they were distributed according to the statistics you expect. So you can't really test to see if the particle is stationary. All you can do is hit it with a measurement and see where it is. That's one of the problems with the de Broglie model, is it makes these quite detailed predictions, but they're not accessible experimentally.
Okay. You said that if we detect the particle somewhere here, then we know for sure that it's coming from this layer.
Yeah.
I don't see why that's true from this model.
You don't see why that's true? It's to do with the no crossing. So here you're just seeing 1 + 1. Dimensions. So there's velocities have to be single valued because they depend just on the wave function. So it's impossible to have trajectories that cross. And then you have to make sure you get the right distribution you have to get the right distribution out. And in a double slit experiment, you have equal probability of detecting the particle on the left-hand side of the screen to the right-hand side of the screen. So if you combine those two facts, it's impossible then for particles to cross in the middle. So they have to either end up on the left-hand side, they have to either remain on the left-hand side or remain on the right-hand side. So it's a consequence of these two sketching facts.
So this model explains interference?
It explains interference. Okay. It's not classical in a Newtonian sense because these are not Newtonian. It's not Newtonian dynamics. You still have a wave function, which is something you don't have in Newtonian mechanics. But it is, in some sense, classical. Yeah, you have a clear picture of what's happening. You can say exactly where particles are, exactly what the ontology is.
I have a question about whether we can start from the delta function, wave function.
Yeah, if we start from the delta function for the distribution.
That means distribution is crossing.
If you start from the delta function, then you only have one position. And you don't ever see the same position. So if you start from the delta function, you remember I mentioned this theorem that you can get. This wouldn't work with the delta function theorem. If you were able to actually prepare your system so they're all initially in some given state, some given position, then it wouldn't end up going to the equilibrium. It wouldn't. Any other? Yeah.
Can we, I guess, like differentiate between like the speed of the wave packet and the speed of the particles on the trajectory? Like, are these particles always interacting at like the front of the wave function, or can they in principle travel at completely different speeds?
What do you mean by the front of the wave function?
In my mind, we have like this picture, and then we have particles taking specific trajectories.
Yeah.
On them. But like, was this wave function there before the particle took a specific trajectory, or?
So the idea is the wave function is evolving through the slits at the same time as the particles are going through it. You can imagine. Strictly speaking, I suppose there would be some. There could be some particles which are in front and some are behind. This is just a 1+1 dimensional sketch. So there's no room for another second dimension. So in this case, there's only one. At a given time, there's a wave function plus. If you went to 2+1 dimensions, then you could talk about the. Ask the question you asked. Anyway, my attitude is it's really good to learn the Broadband model because it helps you think about quantum theory, and it's good when people say things like there's no hidden variable interpretation, or there's no way of saying there are position particles. Well, you know that's not true. I don't think it is a very good departure for making progress in physics. I may be wrong. There's people who think it is, but it's good to know it just what it tells us.
Does it have any prediction in terms of like any different prediction from ordinary?
Okay, so if you assume also point three, the initial distribution is equal to psi squared, then the answer is no. The predictions of the Broadband model are identical to the predictions of standard quantum theory. Every now and then you'll see a paper that says that's not true. For every one of those papers, but in my experience, there's always a mistake. That this just reproduces standard quantum theory. However, if you take the approach that Valentini has been taking, and you say, well, you shouldn't make that assumption, you want to derive it here, what you could do is try to look for systems which are not in equilibrium, systems where rho is not equal to psi squared. And he reasons that systems that came from the early universe that haven't interacted very much with the rest of the universe might be examples of systems. You'd look for these primordial particles that haven't reached quantum equilibrium. If you found things like that, then you would violate quantum theory. And you could do all sorts of things that are crazy, like you can signal faster than light. You can do things in quantum computing you can't do with regular computers. You can distinguish non-orthogonal quantum states, all sorts of things that during standard quantum theory, you can violate them. So if you had access to non-equilibrium particles, then there are real predictions. That would be very important. But probably not going to happen, but if it did happen, it would be. Okay.